Talk given Saturday, 24th January, 1976.
One of the profoundest and most hidden of the facts of our existence is that each one of us, as a human being, each living creature, each particular object throughout the universe is a center for the receiving of energy, the one universal energy, and for responding to it. We do not know this fact at all, really. We may have heard of it somewhere, we may have read of it, but we are, as a human race, and have been from the beginning of time practically, that is to say human, the time during which the human race has been on the globe, we have been quite ignorant of this fact. Consider the constitution alone, the psychophysical constitution. What is it but a congeries of energies at play? And it is not an isolated congeries, for the very simple reason that energy cannot function in isolation. Energy is universal. And wheresoever energy is constricted, whatever the cause of the constriction may be, and forms a particular pattern, that particular pattern is the receiver of energies which preserve this pattern, maintain it, transform it, and bring it into fruition, and in the process, wheresoever that pattern is a self-conscious human being, there is a response from that pattern, that is you or I, to the energies which have been received. I'm putting it in these terms for certain very good reasons. In the ordinary way, we say that man interacts with his environment and his environment influences him in turn. We all know about that in general terms, but we don't appreciate the fact that this interplay is an extremely intimate and total interplay. If you put it in this form, that you and I are centers which receive energy, and that energy works inside us, and we send it out again in some form or other. Consider that fact very, very carefully in that form, and you will begin to appreciate the extraordinary relationship that there is between any one particular being and not only the immediate environment but the total universe. It is this sense of the totality which is missing in us. If the sense of the totality is there, much of our isolative self-consciousness and practically all of our separative object consciousness would disappear. And the result, first and foremost, would be that we would awake to our individual responsibility, not only to our own selves, not only to our immediate circle, family and friends and community and so on, but to the entire world, to the whole cosmos. We are unaware of this. We really are. We may talk about it just because the intellect can quite easily make patterns of words which represent certain ideas, certain thoughts. But there is no intense awareness of it within, in our whole being. If there were, then our whole life, our thoughts and feelings, our words and our actions would be as complete expressions as possible of that awareness. You, you and I know very well the dichotomy between what we say and think, what we do. Why this dichotomy? Not only deliberately do we do things which belie what we may think or say, but we just haven't the capacity to make our action completely accord with our thought, with our perception. Why? A thought as a thought is more or less impotent. It can't do much. We have been through this period, certainly in the Western world, where earlier in this century, and a little before it too, there was this idea that thoughts are things. You must think positively, and thereby you will have success. Now you see how limited that kind of thinking is. It has its roots in utter selfness, in actual fact. And on the whole, it is harmful rather than helpful, both to the individual and to mankind. Because what I think, in that sense, is that which I am planning in servitude to my unchallenged desire, my whim, my fancy, my passion, and so forth, or to a superimposed ideal upon myself or by society which is presented in a fixed mental form, which is always a bondage. But if there is something in inner awareness which really is alive and vital, then that innermost seat of consciousness will always be in line with the trend of life, with that which brings each one of us to fruition in the true sense of the term. Not in the sense of how I, as an individual person with my particular desires and ambitions, may define as fruition, but in the grand sense in which the whole activity of the universe moves me forward, and the transcendent activity of creativeness is drawing me. See, we do not appreciate the distinction between the actual state of inmost awareness and the superficial thinking-feeling process. Thought and feeling, words and actions are superficial. They are the expression, the pressing out by this mysterious, irresistible power which is one's own innermost consciousness. one's innermost awareness. That is the creative power. That is, at least that is one way of trying to understand the nature of this creative power in the universe. And when that is alight in us, it is never wrong. And it moves the living organism and all the energies that flow into the organism and out of the organism in the right direction towards fulfillment. Now remember that such fulfillment may spell pain, what the world calls loss, deprivation. Certainly it will spell so much renunciation and relinquishment of all the puerile, petty, absurd desires and pursuits and follies that we indulge in and have indulged in ever since our primordial ancestor began to change into man. This is something we have to wake up to. And when we wake up to that and truly see it, then two elements go right out of our inner life. Condemnation of anything and everything, and appraisal, approval of anything and anything. And you see the significance of this. Condemnation goes out because there is complete understanding. Approval also goes out because of complete understanding. And that understanding, therefore, is of such a nature that there is no such thing as hate or violence within our own psychological life. In our own psyche, our own mind, there is perfection and purity. There is utter freedom from hate, aversion, violence on the one hand, from desire, grasping, greed on the other hand. And when those two are out, then, to use the Buddha's phrase, one has escaped from the ill state, escaped from sorrow. And by escape, I always say myself, I reject the English word escape, it's a bad word in the context. I have ceased to be a producer and maintainer of the ill state. That is what it means. That's what the word escape actually means in the context of life in its totality. Who is it that spoils the beauty of the universe? Who is a blot on the face of the earth but me, the imperfect human being? Do you find any tree a blot on the face of the earth? Any flower, any animal which lives its life quite naturally? A person might quite justifiably say, would you then tolerate, say, Anopheles, which produces malaria and causes the death of millions? I have no condemnation of Anopheles whatsoever. It fulfills its function according to the laws of its being. It never says no to its function in life as life has made it. Anopheles has no power to choose, I will do this or I will do that. It is in harmony, unconsciously, and unable to oppose what has been laid down for it by life itself, by the evolutionary process. No animal, no tree, no object in the universe as such opposes life and the laws of life. Because it doesn't know the laws of life. That is one reason. It just reacts quite naturally. It can't do otherwise. It can't do other than what the scheme of things has laid down for it. It's only you or I, a human creature, who has the power to say no to life, to say no to the laws of life, and whatsoever brings things to fruition. It is you and I who have the ability to have that sort of devilish cunning which will invent ways and means to counterblast the ill consequences of the evil that we originate in the name of our personal freedom. We are a wonderful lot of stupids. The way we misdefine freedom and truth and beauty and all the rest of it. So now, if in the innermost consciousness of, in our own innermost consciousness, we really wake up to this fact that the energies of the universe, which have brought cosmos into being out of chaos, chaos meaning the primordial state of quiescence of this energy, doesn't mean disorder in this context, the primordial state of quiescence releases cosmos through the activity of these energies. This is the great universal process. And is there any one of us who can deny that cosmos is cosmos? That it is a thing of order, of beauty, of coming, undergoing transformation, which manifests continual fruition, a simultaneity of birth-death as a living pulse? Can anyone deny that? And therefore, can anyone deny that the entire transformation process is one which is a process of life, other life, pulsating? It's only a human being who can go against that. Because in a human being there is this something which differentiates him from all other creatures. This power to say yea or nay. Our consciousness introduces duality into existence. Existence, the universe as such, knows no duality. It has no duality. It is because you and I, constituted as we are aware of our world in these limited terms, and it is because you and I suffer from the defilements of mind, that we introduce this idea of duality as composed of the opposition of complementaries, without which there could be no universal process. There has to be positive, negative, male, female, north, south, and so on. But you see, it is we who do not live, who are not aware in terms of such a harmony, that our lives do not interfere with the harmony and the beauty of the universal process. We are the interferers. But of course, there are advantages also. No creature has the power of adaptation and adaptability as you and I have. No animal has anywhere near that power of adaptation or adaptability. Man can control his environment to an extraordinary degree. He can also adapt himself to conditions which in the normal way would kill any other creature. But man can do it. and being sub-man as he is at present, he has the necessary school of life to enable him to awaken in the depths to this profounder thing which we name transcendence, which we name God, which we name Buddha nature or Christ consciousness or Brahman or any word you like. Or you may use it qualitatively and say perfection or transcendent love or wisdom or whatever you like. Never mind the word, the name. But there is this underlying reality which we must become aware of in our innermost being. Thrill to it right to the very depths of our being. And when we thrill to it right to the very depths of our being, we will cease to be carried away by a set of ideas on the one hand, or by exalted and sublime emotions on the other hand. Now you see, it is this kind of thing which spells the religious life. Religious in the true meaning of the word. That is, the individual self is freed of the bondage and the curse of separateness, of selfness, of self-orientedness, selfishness, if you like, and is now naturally and spontaneously in complete and harmonious relationship within a totality. It is no longer a case of I and you, no longer a case of the self and the not self. That separation is out forever. You are home at last. In the old Upanishad scriptural writings in Sanskrit, they use that wonderful word astam, which means home. You're back home. In fact, you are not back home, but you have woken up to the fact that you are at home, wheresoever you are. Whether you're merely in the body, confined to the body, in your consciousness at the moment, fulfilling the body's needs or whatever it is, or whether you're at home in some wonderful cultural activity or in the commoner garden activities of worldly life, or caught up beyond, wrapped beyond the senses to an exalted state where you really have lost all sense of selfness, separate selfness, and are in that wonderful unio mystica where you yourself now are totally harmless because you are in union with the ultimate reality. The ultimate reality in terms of fact and not in terms of definition by the human intellect. It's very important to really to get hold of this kind of thing. Don't try to grasp it. Don't try to grab it. You might as well try to grasp space. Don't try. You'll waste your efforts. It keeps you. It has hold of you. Why? Because this which appears to my senses and intellect as the void is the absolute real, in which all the dimensions of space and time which I am conscious of are wholly subsumed and are transcended by dimensions totally unknown to me. And that is the void, the absolute fullness which expresses me and you and him and her and this and that and the other throughout the universe. It's that kind of awareness into which we have to awaken. You know, in the Upanishads and in all the great religious teachings and the teachings of the mystics, and particularly in the teachings of yoga, where it is very explicitly stated, they say that what we ordinary mortals, and I am an ordinary mortal as I am, what we ordinary mortals call the waking state is really the sleeping state. I, as I am blind and deaf and dumb and stupid. I am fast asleep, and I am fast asleep in the sick way, the ill way, not the way which is well, which is healthy, which is utterly happy, which is utterly at peace. Now, I mention this for a very good reason. Every one of us experiences this every day of our lives. We enter the state of dreamless slumber for so many hours every day. In that state of dreamless slumber, there is no desire. There is no thought process going on. There is no distortion in my own awareness, in my own mind, of the nature of reality. There is no obstructiveness by me offered to the universal process in the state of dreamless slumber. My life rhythm is entirely in tune with the total life rhythm. That is why when I wake up, the organism is recharged and vital. The great mystery takes place. But of course, it's not held in my awareness. It does not permeate my ordinary awareness when I wake up. The moment I wake up, what happens? All sorts of ideas, thoughts, desires, anxieties, confusions, all sorts of unnecessary fussinesses and busynesses crowd in. Oh, I'm a little bit late, I've got to cook the breakfast for so and so and this, that and the other, and everything is once again a wonderful turmoil. We were in transcendent reality, transcendent peace, goodness, beauty, perfection in dreamless slumber. And when we wake up, back again we are in this turmoil. Now remember, no desires, no thought process, no strains and stresses anywhere in the body or the psyche in dreamless slumber. Now it is that quality which so distinguishes dreamless slumber, which has to come to life and find free expression through all our thoughts and feelings and activities in our waking day. Now, do you get the point? If we can do that, then, if we do that, then, as the Upanishad said, you are truly awake. Why? Because the innermost creative source of your being is now vibrating in perfect tune with the creative energy of the universe itself. That is why. So actually, the perfect state, the utterly purified divine state, which man can realize here and now, and these things couldn't be said even in these halting words unless it were a fact which has been realized through the ages and is being realized. Your perfect state is the one in which you are utterly asleep, completely asleep, in the dreamless slumber quality whilst you are awake in the world. This is the pure awakened state. And the whole of yoga, the whole of meditation, the whole of mysticism, all the religious disciplines, whatsoever they may be, are directed towards this end. If you grasp this, if you understand this, you will see at once the flaw in all the organizations which are intended to take you away from the turmoil of the world and give you peace and build up a static picture of perfection out of your living being. Then you can label it, this is the Holy One. Behold, ecce homo, misapplied ecce homo. What was one of the outstanding characteristics of the perfected Holy Ones? Their perfection and holiness was not a thing which was confined to their little cloister or cave or their little shrine room or to that little fraction of the day in which they were in meditation or something like that. It functioned continuously without let or hindrance. That perfection and holiness stamped itself through everything throughout every day. It's very important to appreciate this fact, because one of the saddest things that has happened in the history of the attempt by sincere, well-meaning human beings to live the holy life, one of the saddest things that has happened to them is that they have separated the so-called holy life from the secular life, and thereby preserved a fundamental, irreconcilable duality, and spoiled the wholeness, therefore, denied the holiness, therefore. But it rests with you and me to wake up to this and to live it. It will come first as a thought, as an idea. You may hear about it as you're listening to me now. At least I hope you are. You're listening to me now. And perhaps it comes as an idea. It may come as a forceful idea. It may come to you as an idea which is just sheer nonsense. How can a little human being sort of become universally conscious and so forth? But be very careful. Don't accept the idea as such. Don't reject it out of hand. Look at it. Let it work. And according to what you really are in yourself, whatsoever you are in yourself, If you let it work, the result will be to your benefit, either in terms of utilizing the idea or in terms of rejecting the idea, because you will then get a better idea. If you, in the quiet, without being perturbed in sight, let the idea interplay with you, and your innermost being interplays with it, you grow, whether you accept or reject. Because if you accept, you accept the outward form as it is presented at this moment. If you reject, you reject that outward form as it is presented at this moment. But if you interplay, you yourself undergo transformation in the act of interplaying, in the process of interplaying. Therefore, you are growing. Now, you see, this perhaps may help you to understand the real nature of this process of spiritual growth, this coming to fruition by the individual of his humanness. And the humanness which has come to fruition is the meaning of divinity. That is the supreme divinity that man can realize within himself. Whoso has realized this has been a fountain source of religious teaching, of being the instrument of revelation of that truth, of those truths which are the power that move mankind as a whole towards fulfilling the purpose of one's individual destiny. I said earlier, we are centers. Each one of us is a nexus, a focus for the inflow and the outflow of all the energies of the universe. Actually, there is but one energy. But that one energy manifests itself to us because our mind and consciousness is of that nature. It splits it up, it analyzes it out. That one energy is seen in many forms. That is why I use the plural, the energies of the universe. You can just call it the one transcendent energy if you like. Transcendent is a word in this context, not meaning something different from the immanent, but simply as being the one total reality, the one total thing. Each one of us is a nexus, a focus. And our business is to be the perfect focus. That is the purpose of our existence with regard to our individual existence. And the other purpose of our existence is to be the instrument through which the universe, totality, comes to fruition in human terms. That is to say, in terms of the transcendent values, beauty, love, wisdom. Intensely feel the impact of the inner reality underlying those words, goodness, and so on. And those things can come to fruition only through us as human beings. Because those things have meaning in our sense, in apotheosis, only for us and not for the rest of the living creation on this planet anyway. Now, people say, is life worth living? What are we here for? What is the meaning of all this process and so on? Do we begin to see meaning? Do we begin to see worthwhileness? Do we begin to see sense in it all? If we do, then each one of us will grow into the perfect little cosmos that God or nature or both, if you like, are moving us towards. The perfect little cosmos, not a chaos in the sense of disorder and sorrow, unnecessary sorrow and suffering. The microcosm will be a true microcosmos, not a microchaos of disorder. This thing which we call order is a power which is inherent in every single manifested thing in the universe. Take an atom. Infinitesimally small. Just learn about the marvelous way in which the atom is an atom, the forces that are involved, and the non-disobedience of the parts that compose the atom in its life process. It is only you and I who can disobey. What beauty there is, what order there is in that atom. Look at a solar system. Look at the marvelous order of it. Look at the whole galaxy. Look at all the different galaxies. And of course, the intellect will suddenly shout out, oh yes, my goodness, and look at the terrible atomic explosions that are constantly taking place in the stars and so on. Did you say terrible atomic explosions? Why terrible? If that wonderful day star, the sun, did not explode away 250 million tons per minute of its substance in mighty hydrogen and other atomic explosions, you and I wouldn't be here. It is that which sends the life, the heat, the light, the various radiations, the energies which spell life and growth and fulfillment for us. Who calls them terrible? I, the ignorant, stupid. No one else does. God doesn't. The sun doesn't. And the charm and the beauty of it. The sun doesn't know that it is doing all this and giving us heat and light and life and beauty and all sorts of wonderful things. It just doesn't know it. And that is goodness. The sun never wears a cloak of goodness, of generosity, of love, of wisdom, of orderliness, of perfection. You and I, when we seek to gain virtues, to develop powers, and so forth, we put on so many cloaks. Now consider all this. The meaning, therefore, of this wonderful order. And there is, in us as individual human beings a most marvelous and specialized meaning of this order within us. All the great religious disciplines, whether they be of the mystic or the religious who follows the path of devotion or knowledge or action or yoga or whatever it is, they all move towards this end. Those of you who are here at our last meetings on the Sunday, you remember I spoke a little bit about yoga, didn't I?
Yes.
And the terms in which yoga is presented. But you will find it very difficult to come across a person who really can help you to wake up to the immensity of the marvel and the truth embodied in each of the elements of yoga. That is, the moralities, the postures and the breathing, the meditation part, and so on. But this is what we must first try to understand with the mind, with the brain. Someday we'll talk more and more about all that. Today, perhaps it is sufficient to have attempted to consider together this very, very important point, that you and I are each a focus, a nexus, for the inflow and outflow of transcendent energies. If you can thrill from within, thrill meaning vibrate, not get excited about it. Excitement spoils it. If you can really vibrate inwardly in harmony with that, you won't know it with the brain, just as the sun doesn't know that its immense atomic explosions spell life and heat and light for us and so forth. You won't know it. But if it can happen inside you, then you will find, as the weeks and the months and the years pass by, that all life changes in a remarkable way. Altogether remarkable way. Unnecessary sorrow, unnecessary confusion and disturbance within the psyche is out. Our psychical energies, which are which have become fossilized, so to say, in distorted manner, come to life again, but all the twists and the pains and the knots, they are all straightened out, unraveled, disentangled, and there is order within the psyche. And you will find that your mental strength, your soul strength, which is the real meaning of virtue, will come out in all its fullness and irradiate your own life and your own being, and make you a benediction for your total environment.